We're going to be in John 7 this morning. There's a common view of Jesus that he is basically Mr. Rogers. That Jesus is warm and kind and he puts children on his lap and tells stories and he tells you to be nice to your neighbor. This is Jesus, meek and mild. And certainly Jesus was kind to children, and he did teach in parables and called us to love our neighbor. But that's not the whole truth about Jesus, is it? You might think of a Navy SEAL. When he's at home, he's romancing his wife and playing with his kids on the floor. He's tender. He's fun. But when he's sent on a mission, he's brave, courageous, bold, and he's ready to run into the most dangerous situations to carry out his mission. And Jesus was on a mission, and there are times, again, where Jesus is calm and having the children on his lap. But there were times, too, when he ran into the heat of controversy, and we're going to see that in our passage this morning. Jesus did not shy away. He could have remained in obscurity, but he went right towards the most dangerous situations when his life was threatened. And so this is not Jesus meek and mild, but Jesus bold and brave. In this passage, Jesus is going back to Jerusalem. He's been in Jerusalem in the past a number of times. Now he's going back. This is about 6 months before his death at the Passover feast, but this time he's going for the Feast of Tabernacles, which would have been in October, about October, on our calendar. And just to get a sense of the danger involved here, I just want to real quick take you back to what we read in John chapter 5, the last time that Jesus was in Jerusalem. In John 5, remember there was this story of Jesus healing this man who was an invalid. He had been an invalid for 38 years. Jesus healed him by the pool of Bethesda. You'd think that would be this great highlight, and in some ways it was. Jesus healed this man, but he actually healed the man on the Sabbath, and so it created this controversy, this stir with the Jewish leaders, with the Pharisees. And they had very strict rules for the Sabbath, weren't to work on the Sabbath, not even to heal. And so this will be on the screen there, John chapter 5, verses 16 to 18. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jews persecuted him. Jesus said to them, "My Father is always at his work to this day, to this very day, and I too am working." For this reason, the Jews tried all the harder to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. So Jesus, for Jesus to go back to Jerusalem now, is his life is threatened. You might think it'd be nice to for Jesus to just live a life of a comfortable rabbi up in the Galilean countryside and retire by the sea and just kind of remain in obscurity. But Jesus, again, he's on a mission. He's come to be the savior of the world. He's not come for a comfy gig in the north. He's come to come right out to the crowds and to share who he is and what his mission is. Remember back in John chapter 1, it said that Jesus came full of grace and truth. He's got to tell the truth. They need to hear the truth about who he is and who God is. They need to know the truth about the message of salvation. And so Jesus has come from the Father, and he's come to open up the love and the grace that is within the Trinity, and he's come to open it up to sinners so that they can be drawn into the family. So he's doing this, and it's all for love. Up to this point, Jesus's ministry has gone along pretty well, pretty smoothly, just again with a couple of exceptions there in John 5. They're threatening his life. But then in John 6, the part we just read last week, remember at the end, all the crowds are leaving. Jesus has given some hard teaching. The crowds are leaving Jesus. And so that kind of brings us to our text for this morning. This is a long passage. We're not going to cover every detail. We're going to be in verses 1 through 36. So I'm going to have to skip over some things, but hit some highlights, hit some main themes, and chase down a couple bunny trails as well. Let's start in verse 1. It says, after this, Jesus went around in Galilee, purposely staying away from Judea because the Jews there were waiting to take his life. But when the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, you ought to leave here and go to Judea so that your disciples may see the miracles you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world, for even his own brothers did not believe in him. Therefore, Jesus told them, the right time for me has not yet come. For you, any time is right. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that what it does is evil. You go to the feast. I am not yet going up to this feast because for me, the right time has not yet come. Having said this, he stayed in Galilee. However, after his brothers had left for the feast, he went also, not publicly, but in secret. Now at the feast, the Jews were watching for him and asking, where is that man? Among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him. Some said, he is a good man. Others replied, no, he deceives the people. But no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the Jews. And we'll stop there. In verse 1, it says that the Jews were waiting to take his life. Again, the word Jews here would stand for the Jewish leadership, the official leadership of the Jews, the Pharisees, the Sanhedrin. Okay, not all Jews want to kill him. It says even in this passage, some of the Jews believed in him. Again, there's that charge that there's anti-Semitism in the Bible. That's just not the case. Jesus is a Jew. His followers are Jews. His ancestors are Jews. Jesus is an observant Jew. So this is not anti-Semitism. But it's referring to the Jewish leadership. The official leadership is opposed to Jesus. We read that the Feast of Tabernacles is near, and we're not going to get through the whole section here, but next time we're studying in John, 2 weeks from now after Wendell is here next week, we'll be continuing in this episode where Jesus is at the Feast of Tabernacles. And so I just wanted to share a little bit about that right now. The Jewish Feast of the Tabernacles was the last in the year of the six major feasts of the Jewish calendar year. Okay, there are six major feasts. Some people will say seven if you include the regular Sabbath. It is in the fall, and observant Jews still celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. In fact, it was just a couple weeks ago, back in October. And this is a big feast. It's a week-long celebration, lots of food. They would take the whole week off of work. It's actually 8 days, but about a week. Okay. According to Jewish historian Josephus, this was kind of everyone's favorite. This was the most exciting holiday. They were to celebrate God's faithfulness to the nation of Israel when they were traveling in the wilderness and living in tents. They would actually erect tents when they're celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, even years later. And still to this day, they erect tents for the week, and sometimes stay out there quite a bit. Sometimes just have a special meal out in the tabernacle or the tent. And so if you can kind of imagine, and it's kind of a Thanksgiving holiday where they're celebrating God's faithfulness in the wilderness, but also it's a kind of a harvest festival. So it's kind of Thanksgiving, but they're also camping out in tents. So it's like 4th of July, Thanksgiving collide into one big awesome holiday and everybody's favorite. We'll also see later that the kind of main symbols at the Feast of the Tabernacles are water and light. Water and light. There are important ceremonies involved in the Feast of Tabernacles that involve water and light. And Jesus is going to use this whole feast to point to himself. He's going to stand up and say, if you want living water, come to me. And then he says, I'm the light of the world. So all this water you see around you, all this light you see around you, it's actually fulfilled in Jesus. So that's for coming weeks, though. So the Feast of Tabernacles is coming up, and Jesus' brothers apparently are excited for this feast, and they come up, and they're encouraging Jesus, you should go down and do your miracles. And it says here in verse 5 that they didn't believe in him. They were skeptics about Jesus. I want to say a few things about these Jesus's brothers here. I think the natural way to read this is that these are Jesus' actual brothers. They would be the children of Mary and Joseph. There are some churches, including the Roman Catholic Church and some Protestant churches, that teach what's called the perpetual virginity of Mary. That is not that just that Jesus that Mary was a virgin when she gave birth to Jesus, but that she actually was a virgin throughout her entire life. And so in that reading or in that understanding, these could not be Jesus' natural brothers, the children of Mary and Joseph. They must have been cousins or distant relatives or even countrymen. I have a slide here. I don't think that is the best understanding. Can you skip ahead there to that? There's a slide. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped this. This is just the artist's rendition. This is not a photo, obviously. But this is a photo of what the temple might have looked like there, celebrating with the lights. And then this is in Israel today. They still celebrate with the tabernacles. They build those booths. Observant Jews do that. So skip ahead to the slide about the brothers. I do think that these are children of Mary and Joseph, that Mary and Joseph had a normal marriage relationship, a normal sexually active relationship, and that these children were born to Mary and Joseph in the normal way. You can see some of the references there. There are several passages in the New Testament that reference Jesus's brothers, and James is referred to as the brother of Jesus. So I think these are actual brothers of Jesus, again, children of Mary and Joseph. Not to go too far down that road there. It does seem like the point of the passage is lost if these are not actual brothers. I think the point of the passage is saying not only are the crowds leaving Jesus, but even his own family, even his own brothers, are not. They don't believe in him. They're not supporting that Jesus is the Messiah. So it seems like they're almost teasing him a little bit. They're saying, "Go down. You can't stay stay in secret if you want to be a public figure. Go down and do these big miracles and show everybody who you are." And they're missing the point. That's not, again, Jesus doesn't do miracles just to wow people, and he doesn't want fans and admirers. He wants followers. He wants people to trust him. He wants people to obey him. So he's not just coming to put on a show, to put on a spectacle, but they want to be his public relations advisors. Tell him to go down to the festival. And Jesus says it's not time yet. It is interesting to think about the dynamics between Jesus and his siblings. What would it take for you to believe that your brother is the Messiah, the Son of God? Anybody have a hard time believing that about if you have a brother, that he's the Messiah, that he's the Son of God? It might be a hard pill to swallow. Imagine, when they're little. Jesus did it. It's Jesus' fault. No, it's really not. Again, he's sinless. So maybe some jealousy involved there. And Jesus' words here, I think, possibly could have provoked them a little bit. They say, "You should go down." And he says, "For you, any time is right. But for me, Jesus has to be in the will of the Father. It's not time." Jesus is very aware, again, of his time, his hour, his approaching death. And it's got to happen, again, according to this time schedule, this time reference. And so he can't just kind of do whatever he wants. He's beholden to the Father. He's got to do everything in the right time. He says to them, "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that what it does is evil." So the implication is that you guys fit in with the world. You're sinners like the rest of the world, and the world can't hate you, but the world hates me because, I mean, amazingly, Jesus says, and again, people that have the Mr. Rogers view of Jesus do not like this. This sounds arrogant and judgy, but Jesus says, "I've come and I'm here to testify that what the world does is evil." And we don't have to look far to know that he's right. What the world does is evil. And not just out there, not just in Pakistan. We prayed for Asia this morning. There's evil here in me. And Jesus is going to bring that home in the coming verses. So continuing on in verse 14. "Not until halfway through the feast did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. The Jews were amazed and asked, 'How did this man get such learning without having studied?' Jesus answered, 'My teaching is not my own. It comes from the one who sent me. If anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. He who speaks on his own does so to gain honor for himself, but he who works for the honor of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There is nothing false about him. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet not one of you keeps the law. Why are you trying to kill me? You are demon-possessed, the crowd answered. Who is trying to kill you? Jesus said to them, I did one miracle, and you are all astonished. Yet because Moses gave you circumcision, though actually it did not come from Moses, but from the patriarchs, you circumcise a child on the Sabbath. Now, if a child can be circumcised on the Sabbath so that the law of Moses may not be broken, why are you angry with me for healing the whole man on the Sabbath? Stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment. Okay, so again here, the setting is the temple. They're there for the feast. These are the early days of the feast. Later, Jesus is going to stand up in front of the whole crowd on the last and greatest day of the feast. But now, again, you can just imagine that the temple was a busy place. It was a big structure, the biggest, you know, kind of the center of Judaism, the biggest building for miles around. People were coming in from all over for the Feast of Tabernacles. And so in the different courts of the temple, there would be, you know, the smell of people and animals and sounds and food, and all that is going on. And Jesus, again, marches right into the hornet's nest here. This is where people want to kill him, and he goes straight there. He's not running away from this. He's not running away from his mission. I don't know about you. I think many of us tend to avoid conflict, don't we? We don't like to rush into conflict. We keep our mouths shut. We don't deal with things, sometimes even that need to be dealt with. But sometimes there's a conflict that we just can't avoid. Our consciences won't allow it. We just have to deal with this. Pastor Mike has shared the quote, I think, from Vernon Johns. It's Vernon Johns that says, if you see a good fight, get in it. Where's Mike? Is that Vernon Johns? If you see a good fight, get in it. You don't get in every fight, but if there's a good fight, a fight that needs to be fought, then you get in it and you do what you need to do to fight that fight. And that's what Jesus is doing here. This is a good fight, a fight to rescue sinful people who, without him, without Jesus, without the teaching that he's going to give, without the grace that he's going to extend, they will perish, and they will perish forever. And so this is a fight that needs to be fought. He cannot, his love will not allow him, his love for mankind will not allow him to sit in Galilee and be comfortable when people are going to perish. So this is a fight to rescue those he loves. And so he begins to teach, and it says that they are astonished. They're astonished. They're amazed at his teaching. Especially, it says that he hasn't studied. Now, not that Jesus hasn't studied. Jesus is God, and so he knows the word. He knows it backward and forward. But he hasn't been in any of the main training centers for Jewish rabbis. And so he's kind of obscure for them. He hasn't come up through the ranks, so to speak. So how did he get this learning is the question. It was common for rabbis to reference those who had trained them. So-and-so trained me, so-and-so sent me, and so I'm now delivering what so-and-so, famous rabbi, taught, and I'm passing it on. And Jesus is saying, there's somebody else who sent me, not another rabbi, but actually God the Father sent me. So he's referencing God the Father sent, he sent me to you. My teaching is not my own, it's from him, it's from the Father. And so, you know, if Jesus was kind of a little boy, he might, you know, if there's a discussion sometimes, my dad's stronger than your dad, my dad's stronger than you times 10, my dad's stronger than your dad times infinity. And Jesus is saying, my rabbi is better than your rabbi times infinity, because my rabbi is God the Father. He's given me like the unadulterated perfect truth. And so your rabbi is, you know, whatever they say, this trumps all other, this outweighs any other rabbi. The authority of God the Father outranks it all. And so you notice in this section, and then what we'll continue to read in the rest of the passage, how prominent Jesus and his relationship with the Father is. That there's this perfect cooperation between Jesus and the Father. And that's deliberate. He's emphasizing that because, again, he wants to show them his identity. He wants them to know, I am the Son of God. Now later, again, in the 2 weeks, we'll see, he just comes out and thunders it. I am the light of the world. Here he's being he's just leading up to that. But he's starting to unveil who he is. This is who he is. I'm not here on my own. I don't have authority all by myself. I just share it with the Father. He deals with this issue of the Sabbath because they're still worried about that. And Jesus has dealt with this question of why can he heal on the Sabbath? In some places he says that he's the Lord of the Sabbath. Sometimes he says that the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And here he takes kind of a different argument of why he's allowed to do healings on the Sabbath. And basically, the circumcision was conducted on the eighth day for in a Jewish boy's life. And they would do that on the Sabbath. If the eighth day of a Jewish boy's life fell on the Sabbath, they would perform the circumcision. That was a work. And they recognized that there are some laws that supersede other laws. So you shouldn't work on the Sabbath. But the command to circumcise it takes precedence. And so we have to do that, even if it's on the Sabbath. And Jesus is saying if circumcision should happen even on the Sabbath, and that's kind of a spiritual, it's a sign. It's a good sign, but it's just a sign that represents something else. Why can't Jesus now heal the whole man? The circumcision was just a pointer. So Jesus is saying, what's wrong with me healing that man on the Sabbath? Because I'm just healing the whole man. Circumcision is just a pointer to that. And so he's just pointing again. He's pointing out their legalistic hypocrisy. To take a little bunny trail here at the end of that section there in verse 24, Jesus says, stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment. Jesus says to judge. He says, make a right judgment. People have said that the most common, the most widely known Bible verse in the United States for a long time was John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he sent his only son, right? But that has changed in recent generations or recent decades, that the most famous Bible verse now is from Matthew 7, judge not, lest ye be judged. Don't judge me is kind of the battle cry of our generation. Don't judge me. Don't judge me or what I'm doing or what I believe. Everybody can do what they want and believe what they want. No judging. But it's interesting, even in that passage, Jesus does not say never judge anyone or any idea at all. He says, if you're going to judge, here's how you should do it. First, remove the plank from your eye, and then go and remove the speck from your brother's eye. So there is, it would be foolish to not be discerning about false ideas and sinful behaviors that are going to bring destruction to your life and others. So Jesus is never saying, have no discernment, make no judgments about right and wrong, make no judgments about truth and error. That's not what he's saying. Not in that passage. And in this passage, again, I think he's just being very clear. Don't judge by mere appearances. Make a right judgment. And so Jesus tells us we actually should. We shouldn't be judgmental. We shouldn't be overly critical. But it's right for us to judge. To judge, again, sin from righteousness, and to judge truth from error. Okay, let's finish out the passage at this. In verse 25. At that point, some of the people of Jerusalem began to ask, isn't this the man they are trying to kill? Here he is speaking publicly, and they're not saying a word to him. Have the authorities really concluded that he is the Christ? But we know where this man is from. When the Christ comes, no one will know where he's from. Then Jesus, still teaching in the temple courts, cried out, yes, you know me, and you know where I am from. I'm not here on my own, but he who sent me is true. You do not know him, but I know him because I am from him and he sent me. At this, they tried to seize him, but no one laid a hand on him because his time had not yet come. Still, many in the crowd put their faith in him. They said, when the Christ comes, will he do more miraculous signs than this man? The Pharisees heard the crowd whispering such things about him. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees sent temple guards to arrest him. Jesus said, I am with you only for a short time, and then I go to the one who sent me. You will look for me, but you will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come. The Jews said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we cannot find him? Will he go where our people live, scattered among the Greeks, and teach the Greeks? What did he mean when he said, you will look for me, but you will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come? So more teaching here that Jesus is giving. This is probably a summarized version of what he's teaching. And the reasons that the Jewish leaders are opposing Jesus just, again, they're piling up. They're piling up. They really start to detest Jesus and what he's doing. Not only does he have bigger crowds than them, or at least at one point did, so they were jealous. Not only is he blaspheming by calling God his Father, not only is he challenging their formal ritualism about things like the Sabbath and circumcision, now he's calling them out for their sin and hypocrisy. He says, you don't know him. You don't know the Father, which would be very offensive to a Jew, especially a Jewish leader. You do not know him. I know him. You do not know him. And he tells them that they're sinners. And these are guys who are just meticulous in trying to follow the law perfectly. And so they do. They've wanted to kill him. And now, even now, they're trying to seize him and arrest him. They're hesitant here. They don't want to put an innocent man to death. They also don't want lawlessness, rioting. You know, there's a lot of people that are supportive of Jesus, but some, you know, they don't want the big crowds following him. But if they let things get too tumultuous there in Jerusalem, then the Romans are going to step in. And we don't want that. We don't want the Romans getting involved here. And so you can almost imagine their hearts sink a bit. These Pharisees, I think they probably liked a lot of what Jesus had to say. They liked maybe the parables and some of the things that Jesus was saying. But as soon as Jesus starts talking about God as his Father and saying that he knows the Father and they don't, I think their hearts begin to sink. And isn't that the way it is in our world, that people kind of like what Jesus has to say in some things, but they like to cut out the other things? And so they're increasingly angry, trying to seize him, trying to put him to death. I want to give you kind of two main application points here at the end. These are things that I'd just like to offer some encouragement, some application to our lives. And the first one is this, that Jesus, I think, in this passage is just a great example for us of how to handle the difficulties of facing controversy and conflict and abandonment by one's family, stress and discouragement. And so those are things that we all face to some degree or other. Some of you may be going through really difficult times even now. And how do we handle those? Can we learn anything from Jesus' example? Again, the crowds largely in Galilee, the crowds had left him except for just the 12, maybe a few others. Even his own family doesn't support him. Now he's, again, marching right into the hornet's nest, and he's got people that are trying to kill him, trying to arrest him. And how does Jesus face all that? And what I want to say are just kind of two pieces of the puzzle here of how Jesus is able to so confidently walk into these situations that were so difficult. And what I want to say is that Jesus was able to face these situations because he kept in close intimacy with the Father and because of his obedient faithfulness to the Father. And so what I want to say is when you go through difficulty, whatever kind of difficulty it is, whether it's conflict with your family, some difficulty at work, some health issue for you or a family member, whatever the stress, whatever the controversy, whatever the conflict is, the importance of staying in intimate relationship with the Father and then just being faithful to him in that. Again, Jesus is constantly emphasizing here in this passage his unity with the Father. I'm not here on my own. The Father's with me. We know that Jesus, when he was baptized, was filled with the Spirit. And so it seems like Jesus is not just kind of a lone wolf here. He's got the company, the companionship of the Father and the Spirit as he goes through his ministry. And we see Jesus often withdrawing to lonely places to pray, to have that special communion with the Father. And again, I think this is just so, so important for us when we go through difficult situations, that we stay in close contact with the Father, that we have that time of being refreshed in the Spirit through prayer and through time in the Word, and allow that close intimacy with the Father to gird us up, to give us strength. And so I just want to encourage you in that whatever you're facing, that is, the Psalms say that God is not far. He's near to the brokenhearted. He's near to the brokenhearted. So when you're in a difficulty, when you're in that stressful situation, when you're facing controversy, stick close to the Father. And stay obedient. Again, Jesus, he's just waiting perfectly on the Father's timing. It's not time to go yet down to Jerusalem. Okay, now it's time to go. I'm going. He just wants to be perfectly surrendered to the Father. And I think, again, that should be our attitude. No matter what difficulties we're facing, I'm just going to be faithful. I'm just surrendered. Lord, I'm available. You can use my feet, my voice, my checkbook, whatever it is. I just want to be available for you to use. So again, a close relationship with the Father and that perfect, well, as perfect as we can get, obedience to the Father. Just be faithful. People may leave me like they left Jesus. I might be abandoned. People may call me names and oppose me, just like they called Jesus demon-possessed. I may face controversy and arguments and awkward conversations. People may smear my character. It seems unlikely at this point in time in history, but I could face something even more serious, jail time or death as a Christian. Some do. But I will walk by faith and obedience to the Father. I will be filled with the Spirit, united to Christ. And in that mode, I have nothing to fear. What can separate me from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus? And so when I face hardship, this is and this is promised. You know, we will, anybody who seeks to be faithful to Jesus will face hardship. I'm just going to stay in the middle of God's will. I'm going to stay close to him. I'm going to stay close to his love. I'm going to be filled by his grace. And I'm just going to be faithful. I'm just going to be obedient. That needs to be our determination. I'm going to pick up some serious scars along the way. But if I can just be faithful and stay near to Christ, that'll be enough. Another application point here for us, and I think I want to just drive this one home here to finish out our time, is that we see here Jesus' passion to get the truth of the gospel to these people. Jesus is passionate about telling the truth about his Father, telling the truth that can save. We are saved not through good works, but by good news, a good news message. And Jesus wants to get them the truth. Just to kind of summarize, and Jesus has said a lot of things here, but here's kind of a little list here of the things that Jesus has been saying about himself. And again, this is just kind of like leading up to when he's going to say, if you want living water, come to me and drink. I am the light of the world. So he's going to thunder it out. And this is all kind of leading up to that. But he's saying these things about himself. He's saying that his teaching is from the Father, that he was sent by the Father, that he's from heaven. He's saying they don't know God. They don't know the Father, but he does. His ministry glorifies the Father, not himself. He's a man of truth. There's no falsehood in him. He claims that. How arrogant that must have sounded. But he says that they have all broken God's law and none of them denies it. Did you catch that? He says, not one of you have kept the law, and they don't deny it. They know it's true. And we all know it's true. We haven't kept God's law. He's communicating. He has supernatural power. He's even updating the Old Testament law while respecting it. He's saying that he can heal the whole man. And then he says at the end there, he's going to go back to the Father. Like, where is he going to go? He's going to go out among the Greeks? No, he's going to heaven. That's why you can't go to be with him. All these things. Again, Jesus is trying to graciously unveil. This is who I am. I'm not just a man. I'm not Mr. Rogers. I'm not just a public figure, a famous preacher trying to get a big crowd following me. I'm the Messiah. I'm sent from God. I'm here to save. I'm here to die and rise again. This is what he's telling them. And then they're having a hard time with it. And to be fair, I understand it would be hard to get that. But he's just trying to make it so plain to them. And he's doing it all for love. Again, at the risk of his own life. He is not running from this. He's coming to tell them this because they need to hear this message. They need to know who Jesus is. These are not, you know, incidental side piece things. For them to know that they don't know God, that they are sinners, that they are in desperate need of rescue. They need to know that. He loves them so much. He's coming to tell them that. You don't know God. You're sinners. You haven't kept the law. You need grace. I'm sinless and from the Father. And I'm here. I've come for you. He doesn't want them to think of him just as a rabbi or a miracle worker. He is the Lord. They have to get this message. And so Jesus, again, I think we can learn from his approach here, his example of just deeply desiring to communicate saving truth, to extend grace through telling the truth. Again, he came full of grace and truth. Jesus is aggressive in telling the truth. He doesn't wait until people come and ask him. He goes to Jerusalem to tell them. I think sometimes we do that. We wait, I'm just prepared to answer their questions if they come to me. Jesus doesn't wait for people to come to him. He goes and tells them the truth. He's aggressive in sharing. I'm not saying we should be so aggressive that we just beat people over the heads with Bible verses, but we should be looking to aggressively share. The people around us are perishing. Jesus knows that. If these people don't know the truth, they will perish. I've got to tell them the truth. Do you have that mentality? I have the truth that saves, not because I'm so smart, but it's been revealed to me through the Bible that salvation is not found in anybody else. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And people out there, friends, neighbors, relatives, whoever, if they don't have Christ, they're going to perish forever. How can I not share the gospel with them? How can I not tell them? I'm not going to just wait for them to come to me. Of course, I'm ready if they do come to me. But I'm going to be aggressively looking for opportunities to take that message to them. So Jesus is aggressive. He doesn't wait. He's strategic. He ties into their calendar and their feasts. He waits for this perfect opportunity when the crowds are there. And when they're thinking about God providing in the wilderness and they're, you know, all the light and the water, he uses all of that to point to himself. So he's strategic. He's focused. He doesn't get sidetracked. He doesn't get into politics. He doesn't get into side theological issues. He's focused. He's persistent. He doesn't give up on them. They call him demon-possessed. Man, if somebody called me demon-possessed, I'm like, I'm going home. They don't appreciate me. But he sticks with it. It's too important. I can't just give up on you. This is, you know, Hebrews says, for the joy set before him. For the joy set before him. This is his treasure, to rescue his bride. He can't give up on them. He won't. What a shame if he would die and people didn't know who he was and what he was doing. He's got to communicate this to them. So just, again, want to encourage us to have this mindset of Jesus here. I've got to share the truth. They need to hear it. They need to hear it. And for me, again, I know there's obviously use wisdom. Don't, you know, start fights on Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving supper, that kind of thing. But, man, we've got to share it. We've got the truth. We've got the saving truth. I don't want people to just think, oh, Phil's a nice guy. Or he goes to a nice church or something like that. They need the content of the gospel message. They need to know who Jesus is and what he's done. Now, I don't think I'm good at this. I know I'm not good at this. Just to give you one example of what this might look like, and I'm not a great evangelist or anything like this, but recently we were up with Carolyn's family and her grandma, who's 96, I think, lives there, 97. And I went over to her apartment. They have a little apartment that's just next to their house. And I went over and I just said, hey, can I talk to you about some things? And I said, a lot of people at our church that I talk to, I talk to them about spiritual things. And I don't know that I've had that kind of conversation with you very much. And so do you mind if we talk about those things? And she was totally open to that, 97, but very open to that. And we had a fantastic conversation. I think she already knew the gospel. Carolyn's mom has been sharing things with her, but I just tried to share and, you know, point her to grace again. And I really think she understands, but it was just a really wonderful conversation. It's like a little bit scary. Why is that? It's like, I don't need to be scared. This is the good news, you know? And if she pushes back, then I stop. But why not at least try to make those opportunities happen? In the chapter here, there's several places where it says there's whispering. You know, the crowds are whispering. They don't want to, like, come out and have these conversations out in the open because they're afraid of the Pharisees. So they're whispering. It said widespread whispering there early on in the chapter. Widespread whispering. I think people care about spiritual things. They do. They want to know. They care about heaven, and they're aware that they're going to die. They do care about these things. And so I think sometimes we're like, oh, we don't want to step on anybody's toes and bring up spiritual things. I think people want, there's widespread whispering. Now, some, again, they'll push back right away and, okay, not going down that path with them. But some people, I think, are eager to talk about it. They are. There's a quote that I love by Charles Spurgeon. He basically says, if people are going to go to hell, if they really want to be away from the Father, they're just going to do their own thing. If they want to go to hell, at least they should fight their way past me. Like, I'm going to be trying to plead with them, and like, they're going to have to jump over me and push through me to get to hell, because I out of love and concern, and, you know, I want them to know the truth. And so I'm going to do whatever I can. I'm going to warn them and pray for them and talk to them. So at this point, Jesus is going up to Jerusalem to tell them who he is. In 6 months' time, from what we're reading here, he will be going up to Jerusalem again and again into the hornet's nest. This time not to do a lot of teaching, but to die. So this is in preparation for that. I'm going to call the music team up here just to drive this all home, tie it up. Again, Jesus did not come for a comfy rabbi gig in Galilee. Remember when the angel told them to name him Jesus, they said, name him Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. Jesus came to be the Savior of the world. In this passage, he's telling them the truth. And next time he comes up to Jerusalem, he will be ready to die as the sacrificial lamb for the sins of mankind.